This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in African Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Esperanza Brizuela Garcia, and today I will be talking to Dr. Ken Ochieng Opalu about his 2019 book, Legislative Development in Africa, Politics and Postcolonial Legacies, published by Cambridge University Press. Dr. Opalu is an assistant professor at the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Dr. Opalu, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. I wonder if you could begin by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Yes. So I am an assistant professor in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. I'm a political scientist by training. I was born and raised in Kenya, came to the U.S. for undergraduate, ended up staying to get my Ph.D., and it was during the PhD program that I got interested in the question of political development and institutions more generally. And that interest then drove me to become a little bit more focused on the institutions of legislatures. Because when I began looking at intra-elite politics and the study of institutions more generally in political science, I noticed this big gap as far as the study of African legislatures went. And so that's how I started developing an interest in trying to figure out, what explains the variation in the strength of legislatures and autocracy, and under what conditions can democratic legislatures emerge from their autocratic foundations.
I wanted to talk to you about that because, I'm a historian, not a political scientist, but I have noticed a significant lack of literature about just legislative bodies in general. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about that literature, whatever it exists from the political scientists. Your book is very historically focused too. So I'm imagined you also know the historical literature as it's obvious in your book and in your introduction. So can you tell us a little bit just about the state of that literature, of that historical and from both sides, from the historical and from the political science? What do, before your book, what would a reader find if you try to encounter this this topic?
Yes. So before my book, within political science, broadly defined, there had been this very robust literature on legislatures in North America and Europe, with a smattering of studies of legislatures from elsewhere. But the core theory, theories and empirics that drove our understanding of legislatures were ideas from the evolution, in particular, of the UK Parliament, the Parliament in the United Kingdom, and the United States Congress. As a researcher, it quickly became clear that some of those theories were not applicable in the context that I study. For instance, one of the core ideas behind legislative strength is the notion that legislatures control the budget. They have the power of the purse, and that's an important source of their power. So that, Congress in the United States can force a government shutdown. Parliament in medieval England, went to war with the king and could deny him, the king or queen could deny them resources for war. And that was a source of concessions from the monarch or the U.S. executive to legislatures. But when you look at legislatures in many developing countries, that's not true. Many of these legislatures were created under colonial administrations. and were actually created to be weak. And so at independence, they had these overdeveloped executive branches relative to the legislature. And so, you know, while the process of legislative development in the US and Europe is defined by this balancing of power between strong legislatures populated by elites who can actually balance the executive, in the developing world and post-colonial world in particular, what you had were, you know, these strong presidents who then presided over regimes that had very weak legislatures. So legislative development in post-colonial contexts had an overdeveloped executive branch and a weak legislature. And so the evolution of legislatures in those contexts was a process of catching up. And so in the book, that's what I try to analyze, this process of legislative development in the shadow of a strong autocracy. Then the second thing in the particular case of sub-Saharan Africa, what happened is that as soon as many African countries gained independence in the 60s, there was an initial attempt to study these institutions. Unfortunately, by the mid-70s, many African countries which had gained independence under quasi-democratic systems quickly descended into autocratic single-party rule, a pattern that was, you know, fairly common across the world at the time. You know, Latin America's dictatorships, the last ones began to fall in the 80s. In sub-Saharan Africa, the late 80s, also the time many of these dictatorships fall. And so what you see is that as countries were becoming more autocratic, the study of legislatures died because most scholars assumed that these legislatures were epiphenomenon or, you know, not influential as far as, you know, politics and actual policy outcomes were concerned. And so part of my effort is also, in addition to coming up with theories that explain legislative development in post-colonial context, one of my efforts is also to show that, you know, these legislatures under autocracy actually were influential in recruiting elites, providing arenas for intra-elite politics, and for stabilizing politics in African countries in different ways.
I found that particular point incredibly important, not just from the point of view of, you know, balancing the historiography and understanding how politics evolved from colonial times through the present time, but also largely because it sort of allowed us to sort of move beyond both the temporal and sort of like the single actor explanation, isn't it? So I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit. The second chapter of your book is a broad historical overview of legislative development in Africa. And in addition to this, especially from colonial times, and you make a very good case of how important the specific differences between not just between how legislative bodies were created in different colonies, but how the transition to independence happened in each particular colony, how those had a lasting impact on the subsequent development of those bodies. Can you just give us maybe a couple of examples of like the differences and what differences actually mattered in trying to understand the comparative development of different bodies in different colonies?
Yes, and thank you for that great question. If I may begin by you know, just giving some background on why I wanted to get at the details of legislative development, especially in the late colonial period. You know, one of the more famous studies on institutions or the impact of colonial institutions is a paper by Acemoglu, Johnson, and Robinson that basically looks at settler mortality during the colonization era across European colonization across the world, and uses that as an instrument to then explain institutional outcomes in the mid to late 90s across the world. And the general finding is that places that had high rates of European mortality were therefore not colonized and had extractive institutions established there. And because of that, they've had worse outcomes in the present, and places that had low European mortality had European settlement and institutions set up, productive as opposed to extractive institutions. And that explains present day good outcomes, if you will. Now, you know, while that story may be broadly true, I think in order to fully understand the process, we needed to know the details. And the details were that, you know, it's definitely true that one of the primary ways in which colonialism influenced post-colonial institutional outcomes, and I should also add that, you know, much of the existing literature on institutions actually doesn't study a particular, you know, concretized institution. It's often, you know, the outcome of interest is often economic growth, rule of law, protection of property rights, etc. And so my motivation was to say, let's look at one colonial institution, legislatures, which were established under colonialism, and then track them over time and see how they evolve from their founding to the moment of independence, and then what happens after. And so one of the key findings in the book is that time matters, right? Older legislatures are stronger. And this is kind of obvious, but also not so obvious, because if you consider the case of, say, Kenya, right? So the Kenyan legislature is relatively older compared to the Zambian legislature, which I also look at in great detail in the book. In the case of Kenya, the legislature is founded in 1907. In Zambia, it's about in 1924. In the case of Kenya, even though, you know, Black Kenyans are not allowed to be part of the legislature until the mid-40s, just the fact that, you know, the legislature was older meant that over that time, the institution had evolved to have processes and procedures and a culture that even when Black Kenyans were finally able to join, their incorporation and socialization into how the legislature worked made the institution stronger, relatively stronger at the point of independence. While you had variation within British colonies, Kenya and Zambia, to make this point, you just need to look at, you know, the contrast with, say, French or Belgian colonies in Africa. So on average, former British colonies in Africa tend to have stronger legislatures, in part because the British colonial administrations typically had established legislatures right off the bat. In the French case, at independence, the typical French colony had a legislature that was only 16 years old, because many of these territories 14 years old, sorry. Many of these territories gain territorial legislatures in 1946, and then it's a quick sprint to 1960 when they become independent. And so colonial age of legislatures is strongly correlated with post-colonial legislative strength, and the mechanism there is just, you know, the process of socialization, development of culture. You know, the entire political economy is then structured to engage with legislatures as important political actors. And that culture then persists even after the colonial administration has left and then post-colonial elites are in charge.
Related to that point, I guess we could move to start to sort of connecting that to what you do in chapter three, which in a way, as I was preparing for the interview, I think like the question that was answered to me is why legislatures become really important even under this, like you mentioned, overdeveloped. I mean, like right after independence, we don't have a quick jump into authoritarianism, but like you said, African nations did inherit a very overdeveloped executive. So even though they're not right off the bat autocracies, they still have a significant amount of power. And that sort of balancing of power is not something that comes right away. And you present this really interesting arguments about how, despite that seemingly great power that executives have, even at the moment of independence, whether it's the executive or whether it's like a ruling party, for instance, there is still like a need for legislatures. They still serve an important purpose. And I think when you talk about sort of credible commitments, et cetera, that you talk about in chapter three, you make a very interesting point about that. Can you tell us about what makes legislatures important, but at the same time, something that needs to be kept under control?
Yes. You know, no one governs alone, right? So even the most autocratic leadership needs elites who can comply and help in projecting the power of the autocrat. And so students of autocratic institutions have credibly shown that, you know, autocratic institutions matter. And in the case of legislatures, one of the primary, you know, the legislatures under autocracy serve four key functions. One is the incorporation of elites into the regime. So in order for autocrats to be able to govern, they need a minimum proportion of elites who are invested in the regime, and legislatures provide a credible commitment in that regard. In the sense that, you know, once you have elites sitting together in a council or a legislature, it becomes a credible commitment because the legislature allows them to be able to organize and to monitor the autocrat. And this is useful because governing through force alone can quickly become very costly, so that even the most ardent autocrats still rely on some modicum of compliance, or, you know, quasi-voluntary compliance from elite and the masses alike. So just as a matter of intra-elite politics, legislatures play that important role of enabling intra-elite bargaining and political stability. A second function is the function of information. So, you know, any government, whether democratic or autocratic, always has an information problem. You know, knowing what people actually want, or knowing what is actually right and ought to be done, right? So having a legislature allows elites to debate, to voice their concerns to the autocrat, and to voice the concerns of citizens or other interested groups in society. And that is also an important function. Because you can imagine that, you know, if you're an autocrat who's feared by your regime agents, sometimes, you know, your regime agents often have an incentive to lie to you because they don't want to be seen in a bad light, especially when things aren't going well. So it helps to have an institution that can reveal information that may otherwise not be available for the autocrat. And, you know, we typically tend to assume that autocratic legislatures are often on complete lockdown, lacking any information, but that couldn't be further from the empirical evidence, right? If you look at the legislatures that I study in Africa, whether it's in autocratic Tanzania, Zambia, Kenya, Senegal, what you see are, you know, even under autocracy, there was always room for debate. Within bounds set by the autocrats, for sure, but there was always room for debate, and there's ample evidence that those debates actually eventually influenced outcomes. So that in the 80s, when Tanzania is, for example, trying to pass a budget that legislatures don't like, they delay that process and force the president to reconsider. And that's information that was revealed just because legislators were debating the budget. Now, another function is the function of representation. So, you know, in addition to worrying about elites, autocrats have to worry about the masses. And, you know, it helps to have the masses feeling like they're represented and incorporated into the system. That provides a mechanism for ensuring, you know, political buy-in from the masses and preventing mass rebellions. And And it provides an interesting feature of autocratic legislatures in the sense that, you know, if you look at Kenya, Zambia, Lisa Blades has a fantastic look at legislatures in the legislature in Egypt. What you see is that the autocrat allows for competition, relatively open competition at that, because they want to signal that they care to know that the people in the regime who serve as part of the regime's legislature are actually people who are reasonably popular among the masses. And so you see high turnover rates. Some of it is engineered by the regime for sure, but some of it is also driven by a genuine popularity contest. And then finally, you know, the same legislatures also serve to reveal information about elite interests, right? So, you know, if you have a legislature, you can have elite buy-in, but it also provides the autocrat a means through which to monitor elite behavior so that if an elite steps out of line in the legislature, the autocrat can begin to see what their true preferences lie and maybe purge them. Or should an elite become too popular with the masses, they can also be purged. So that it's always a balancing act, right? And that's another lesson that I hope comes through in chapter three, that politics does not is not non-existent under autocracy. There's quite a bit of politics under autocracy because, you know, governing is always a balancing act. And over time, you know, there are periods when elites have relative power, are relatively more powerful vis-a-vis the autocrat. And during those periods, they get more concessions. And then when the autocrat has more power, they can extract concessions from fellow elites.
Thank you for that explanation. That was very, very clarifying. Now, the next three chapters, you introduce your case studies. You have two comparative case studies, Kenya and Zambia. And I guess the one question I remember having as I started reading these three chapters, because they're so rich, is, if you had, I mean, obviously you had this very, very rich body of evidence about Kenya and Zambia. Why did you, at what moment you realized that you could extend some of the arguments that you were, what you were seeing in the Kenya and Zambia examples to other parts of Africa, and basically that you had possibly something to say about legislative development in Africa or even in the post-colonial world more generally than just in Kenya and Zambia?
Yeah, so the process was iterative in the sense that when I got interested in the question of legislatures, one of my advisors was cautious, as advisors ought to be, and, you know, wanted to make sure that there was there before I invested an enormous amount of time in studying legislatures. So I collected data to establish whether there was interesting continental variation on outcomes of interest. And after, you know, after finding out that, yeah, it is true that legislatures vary in their strength and capacities over time, it also helped that Joel Barkan, who unfortunately passed away a number of years ago, he had done some work in an edited volume, also, you know, trying to revive the study of African legislatures and showing that there was interesting variation and raising interesting potential questions that researchers should examine. So having had this continental overview, Kenya became the natural country to study for the simple reason that, you know, many works on legislatures, especially Barkan's work, had pointed out that Kenya has one of the stronger legislatures on the continent. And you know, the other countries being South Africa, and then much smaller polities like, you know, the Seychelles, Cape Verde, Mauritius, Botswana to some extent. And so Kenya was in that sweet spot of being a big enough African country with interesting variation and a legislature that was gaining in strength. And so I became more curious and started looking into the Kenyan case. And while doing that, Zambia became the next thing because, in part because there have been very interesting Kenya-Zambia comparisons. And it helped that, you know, both were former British colonies with a substantial European immigration and settlement in the early 20th century, which made them interesting comparative cases. And then it was during that process of reading more about colonial legislatures in Africa that I started threading these patterns, right? Yeah, it quickly became clear that, you know, the British administrations were very eager to establish local legislative councils as soon as they could. In Francophone West Africa, France, throughout its colonies across the world, had this system of assimilation whereby instead of establishing strong institutions in the colonies, colonial elites were actually represented in Paris. And I argue in the book that that's also, you know, a strong reason why former French colonies have weak legislatures, because they did not have territorial legislative institutions for long during the colonial era. So, you know, to answer your question, the process was looking for interesting variation that I could explore, settling in on one case being Kenya, looking for an interesting comparative case, going back to the history and reading up on the rich history, which is in chapter two, and then uncovering these broad patterns that appear to exist in the historical record.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I'm always curious about how these decisions get made at one point, or when does the bulb turns on, you know, in your head. It's like, oh my God, I've seen this before, or this could go well together. But anyway, now that we are fully into chapter four, tell us a little bit about those, you know, what is the comparative value between Kenya and Zambia? You talk about why is it that, you know, there's a lot of similarities. They're both British colonies. But there's something very particular, obviously, that took these two states in very different directions when it came to their legislative development. So can you tell us a little bit of what those differences were?
Yes. So let me start with the colonial era differences. So Kenya, as a colony, is actually established as a colony by accident because the British administration at the time was actually more interested in Uganda than the territory that later on became Kenya. But once it was established, there was a lot of arable land that attracted a lot of settlement from the UK. Much of the settlement was in agriculture, and that will become important for reasons that will become apparent shortly. And it was also settled by a more upper class, relatively upper class British and South African people, colonial settlers. Zambia, on the other hand, is colonized in the process of Southern African colonization more generally. It's the colonial settlement is mostly driven by mining and some agricultural interests. But it's the mining towns in the Zambian copper belt that attract waves of European settlement. Colonization in Zambia also evolves in the shadow of the politics of South Africa and racial segregation in South Africa. And so as these colonies are progressing through the first half of the 20th century, what you have are very distinct types of politics in both places. So, you know, in Kenya, the conflict becomes about land. There's quite a bit of land expropriation beginning in the early 19-teens from Africans, land that was then expropriated and given to European settlers. So African agitation was for land, favorable labor policies, and generally fairer treatment by the colonial administration. In Zambia, the challenge is about rights in the urban copper belt. You know, the African mine workers battling it out with European mine workers and the mining companies that were running the mining towns in the copper belt. Now, in the Kenyan case, there's a colonial legislature, the Legislative Council, that's founded. It begins as a Europeans-only institution. South Asians are included, then Africans are included. Importantly, the mainstream Africans, African elites who lead the independence movement, are part and parcel of the Kenyan legislature, especially beginning in the late 50s. One characterization of the Kenyan independence movement is that it is fairly institutional, in the sense that the leading elites who lead the decolonization process are socialized into the habits of the colonial legislature in the period leading up to independence. In Zambia, because of the race politics of Southern Africa, so Zambia at the time is Northern Rhodesia. Southern Rhodesia, as some of your listeners may know, is currently Zimbabwe, also run by a minority white government. And then, of course, South Africa was also run by a minority white government. And one of the fears of Africans in Northern Rhodesia at the time was that Northern Rhodesia would look something like either Southern Rhodesia or South Africa. And so race becomes this major sticking point across the board, which leads to a complete rejection of most of the colonial institutions. You know, to summarize everything, in Zambia, the decolonization process is in many ways extra-institutional. So that instead of having an institutionalized process of socializing future elites, because of the failure to compromise on the question of race and racial exclusion, the Zambian decolonization process is one of rejection of the colonial institutions. The leading elites, very few of them are actually part of the Zambian Legislative Council. Being part of the Zambian Legislative Council, the Northern Rhodesian Council, becomes, a blotch on one's career because it's seen as collaborationist. While in the Kenyan case, there was never that sense that, you know, joining the LegCo was collaborationist. In fact, you know, these were celebrated heroes because they were seen to be winning the institutional fight. Now, one other thing that we should recall about Kenya and Zambia is that political development in Kenya, while it is institutionalized, it's also heavily ethnicized. What you had in Kenya were very weak parties based on districts that were created along ethnic lines. So Kenya also progresses towards independence with a very weak national independence party. In Zambia, because it's incredibly urbanized, as early as the late 30s, political development is also not strictly along ethnic lines. You have in UNIP and previous parties in the ANC and then UNIP, parties that were not strictly speaking ethnic parties. So in Zambia, you have a truly nationalist independence movement with a broad-based national party, or at least a lot more national of a party than what you see in Kenya in the Independence Party KANU, which is essentially a confederation of district-level come ethnic parties. On the eve of independence, when you look at the institutional development and its future successes, it is fair to say that the Kenyan legislature was a lot stronger than its Zambian counterpart, and that a lot more of the future post-colonial elites in Kenya were a lot more socialized in the habits of how parliaments work in Kenya than they were in Zambia.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Oh, thank you. And I guess that sort of sets the stage for what happens through decolonization, and which is the subject of your fifth chapter. You know, when you talk about this, how, you know, these executives interacted at this moment in the cases of Kenya and Zambia with their specific legislative bodies. And you obviously touch upon this particular institution's ruling parties and other administrative apparatuses that had been inherited, or in the case of Zambia, like you said, kind of try to rebuild them as a way to reject that colonial legacy. Could you tell us a little bit about the interaction of all these different bodies and what is the outcome in terms of the legislative strength of legislators?
Yes. So this, in thinking about what happens after independence, and going back again to chapter three, I came up with this idea that, you know, it's hard to think about legislatures in isolation from other institutions of state, right? So the conceptualization that I have of the processes of legislative development after independence hinges on examining, you know, what were the options of projecting power for post-colonial elites? Because post-independence, presidents in Kenya and Zambia face the challenge that they have to govern with the legislature, right? So the question then becomes, how do you manage elites who sit in a legislature? And while it's true that presidents could balance legislatures, there are lots of examples of times when legislatures actually tried to overpower presidents. So there was always going to be politics. And what happens post-independence is that in the Kenyan case, you have a weak national party, which, the president then fails to empower, in part because the party at the time was dominated by a faction that was not fully in line with the president's ideology. And so the president wants to weaken the party even further than it was at independence. And because of the weakness of the ruling party in Kenya, parliament then emerges as the institution of intra-elite politics. And so debates that could have happened in the party as they did in Zambia actually happened in the legislature. I also have this notion of means and ends independence, right? The idea that, you know, under autocracy, presidents always get what they want. It matters how they get there. In some contexts, presidents will set the goal and allow the legislatures to figure out how to achieve the goal. In other contexts, you know, presidents will write the law and force legislatures to just have an up or down vote on it. In the Kenyan case, because the party was weak, the president adopted the former option, which was setting the goal and allowing the legislature to find its way to the goal. And I argue that, you know, this idea of means independence allowed legislatures, the legislature in Kenya, to develop the institutions, internal institutions, needed to be able to evolve and grow as an institution. And you see this in the number of sittings that the Kenyan legislature has, the number of bills passed, and just the content of the debates. In Zambia, well, as I said, what you get is a strong nationalist party at independence. And the party is so strong that it actually overwhelms the legislature. So that while in Kenya, party weakness was accompanied by legislative strength, what you get in Zambia is that the strong party actually substitutes for the legislature. So that what you get is that debates happen within the ruling party UNIP. And because the UNIP is dominated by the president essentially runs the show, such that, you know, you have major constitutional amendments that are passed with very minimal debate within a single day in parliament. So the Zambian parliament lacks means independence in the sense that everything is decided outside of parliament and the parliament merely rubber stamps policies coming out of UNIP. And so this And I part of the one of the explanation of this process is that because of the Zambian president's incentive to basically abandon colonial institutions, including the Colonial Field Administration architecture, the president had a fairly strong party but a weak administrative structure. And so, you know, there was this paradox of, you know, strength and weakness combined, that the president had a strong party but an inability to fully control the country because he lacked this administrative infrastructure to actually control the country. While in Kenya, you have this weak party but a strong administrative structure, so that the president could actually cede power in Kenya, some power to elites, knowing full well that he had an administration that could help him balance the elites if it came to that, you know, monitoring what elites were doing and actually influencing outcomes on the ground. And so part of the reason why the Zambian president does not allow for means independence is this fear that while the party is strong, the party could also be hijacked by fellow elites. And so he hoards all the power. And so because of this, over time, and time is a very important variable here because institutional development takes time. Over time, the Kenyan legislature develops the institutions needed to grow and become a strong institution, even under autocracy, while the Zambian legislature finds itself stunted over time.
One of the, I think, strengths, or one of the things that I found particularly, I was particularly amazed in your book, is how you manage to, you not only do you have a wealth of data, but the data is used in very insightful ways. And so I wonder if you, like when you talk about means independence and ends independence, you have a very specific way to measure those things. Like you said, you talked about sittings in parliament, time spent debating, time, number of bills that have been passed by parliament, etc., both, you know, before the transition to multi-party politics and after the transition to multi-party politics, etc. So I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that process of deciding what were the right measures that would help you substantiate your arguments, and just the process of collecting this data. It just seems quite an endeavor.
So I should say that, you know, one of my inspirations was, just being very envious of my colleagues who study American politics and all the data they have, right? So, you know, if you study the U.S. Congress, debates are readily available, the voting records are readily available, congressional time is tightly tracked and everything. And so I didn't want to just write an institutional history of these legislatures. I wanted to get at some of the politics in them. And so because, you know, as a social scientist, I also wanted to have something that was empirically tractable so that we could have, you know, evidence to support the claims I was making. And to get the measures of legislative strength, an important influence was the work of Paulsby, who was a student of the U.S. Congress, and, you know, he has these measures of institutional strength. So the degree to which an institution is bounded from the external environment, so internal rules and practices and procedures, the degree to which, you know, members see themselves, again, as a corporate entity that is separate from non-members. In Chapter 7, when I look at the electoral dynamics, you know, I'm trying to get at, you know, is it the case that it's hard to get into this institution or not? And that then pushed me to look for concrete ways of measuring this. And so the idea behind tracking the share of executive bills passed was to ask, you know, is it the case that these parliaments were merely passing bills, every of the bills coming from the executive, or was there a scope for them to actually debate and kill some of these bills, right? I really like that measure in part because you can imagine that presidents will only allow debate on bills, especially on autocracy, on bills that they're comfortable to see passed. And so, you know, seeing that even in autocratic Kenya, right, the passage rates were well below 90% was encouraging and showing that these actually were legislatures were actually putting having input in the policies proposed by the president. Looking at legislative time, you know, time is a valuable commodity in legislatures. The more legislatures meet, the more issues of state they can address. Executive rulemaking is an important expression of executive power vis-a-vis legislatures, because in both Kenya and Zambia, presidents do not have outright decree powers. Whatever decree powers they have are delegated by the legislature. So I wanted to see to what extent do presidents use that power without oversight from legislatures. And so, you know, the process of collecting this data, because none of this was readily available for downloading online, was to actually spend about 13 months in both Kenya and Zambia in the parliamentary libraries and archives, just going through the records. And I was lucky that both countries have very good records. And so just going through the records and manually coding and recording this data. Thankfully, since then, especially in Kenya, some of these records have now become available online and can be, they're still in PDF format, but they are available online for download. You know, to answer your questions about the data collection process, it was just hours upon hours in the library. I made very good friends. and it also afforded me time to see how the processes that generated my data actually played out. So while at the library at Parliament in Kenya and in Lusaka in Zambia, I was actually also able to interview MPs and attend some of the parliamentary sessions in the two legislatures.
Well, you know, those are the perks, I guess, from hours and hours in libraries. One of the factors that you obviously thought of important enough as to be a contribution or detriment, whichever the case may be, to legislative independence is electoral politics. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about why that factor was particularly important in your view, and what is it that it contributes? You know, what is that elections, I mean, apart from the fact that, you know, it's through elections, I guess, that legislators get into parliaments. But you have a very compelling set of arguments here as to why this is another aspect of legislative development that we need to keep in mind.
Yes. So part of the motivation was that, you know, elections are crucial for the representative function of legislators, right? It's how legislatures recruit members. And so it's a crucial element to the institutional politics of legislatures. Yeah. The other thing that I was also very interested in was that time in the legislature is crucial for institutional development. Strong legislatures have career members who are invested in the strength and prosperity of the institution. You know, they invest in knowing how the legislative processes work. They invest in being experts in particular issue areas, whether agriculture, education, infrastructure. They invest in building the networks needed to get bills passed. And they invest in having the means to use their institutional power to effectively balance the president. And so an amateur legislature is a weak legislature. Because to have the institutional memory and the skills needed to effectively use the institutional power of the legislature, One necessarily needs the time needed to build the networks within the institution needed for that purpose. And so in the book, I make the strong case that, you know, strong legislatures ride on the backs of strong individual legislators. And to become a strong legislator, you need to spend more time in the legislature. And so you need to be able to be reelected. And, you know, Mayhew, who is a scholar of the U.S. Congress and politics generally, made this important point that, you know, the U.S. Congress is designed to, the internal organization of the U.S. Congress is in many ways designed to further the electoral interests of the members, right? Members do most of the things they do to get reelected, and that's part of their strengthening. So that, you know, a strong legislature will have members who get reelected at high rates, and then those members will further invest in their reelection. And so when looking at Kenya and Zambia, one of the things that I saw was that before autocracy, when these legislatures were not fully free, members had relatively less control over their own career prospects. But if you look at the evidence post-1990, with more freedom, they were better able to invest in their own re-election. And their vote share, their relative vote share compared to comparable challengers actually began to go up. And, you know, Kenya also has this very vivid constituency development fund, which is a very clear attempt by incumbent legislators after 2003 to get resources that they could use to invest in their own re-election. And I see that as part of this process of incumbent legislators trying to use their institutional power to invest in their own political careers. And so one of the lessons of Chapter 7 is that if you look at organizations like the UN, UNDP, USAID in the US that promote legislative strengthening programs, they often focus on, you know, very technical aspects of the lawmaking process, drafting, how to set up committees, etc. Those are certainly very important features of legislative strength, but, you know, equally important, or perhaps more important, is this notion that, you know, legislatures are only as strong as their individual members. And so having members who are capable of effectively serving their constituents and winning re-election is a necessary step in building the institutional strength and institutional memory of legislatures that will then be able to fully balance executive branches.
Good. So having sort of gone through all those last three chapters, I wonder if before we move to the full conclusions of the book, we could start with just with the stating of like your basic, or not basic, but your most important conclusion, I guess, you know, which is or answer the question that you set out yourself to answer. You know, what happens when this transition happens between when either one of these two states, either Kenya or Zambia, has to transition this time from a single party system to a multi-party system, and how the what do you mean, like having a legislature that had a certain degree of means or larger degree of means independence allowed for a legislature that was further along the way of becoming either a strong legislature or a stronger legislation, because I think you always present that, like you said, is a time continuum. But Zambia was a little bit, or not a little bit, but was further behind precisely because it hadn't had. And especially what I found very interesting is how there's a strong correlation with the level of personal or, you know, political comfort that the autocrat had, you know, in the sense that if you mentioned if the autocrat himself feels very comfortable in power, it seems to allow for greater independence of means. But if that is not the case, it has a much tighter control of the legislature, and that in turn stunts the legislature. Can you tell us a little bit about that part of the argument? Because I found that, I mean, I think that's the part of the argument that seems the most counterintuitive, but definitely bears out by the evidence.
One of the ironies of political development is that, you know, we tend to lump all autocratic countries in one bucket, right? But if you look at the historical record, right, the autocracies that are fairly stable and seem to have stable institutional practices, and then the autocracies that are largely chaotic in the sense that institutionally chaotic in the sense that, you know, elites actively undermine institutions. And so the idea there was that a strong autocrat who's confident in the ability to balance elites will allow for, will have legislatures as a matter of course, because it's also true that, you know, the autocrats will abolish legislatures and just govern by decree. So you need some confidence in the ability to balance legislatures to allow them to exist in the first place. And then if you're also confident in your ability to effectively monitor them while they're serving the legislature, you will allow elites some modicum of means independence in arriving at outcomes. So that, you know, in Kenya, for instance, the president, you know, couldn't stop legislators from electing a deputy speaker that he didn't like after the 1974 election. And he let it happen. Eventually, he arrested him after the emboldened deputy speaker and some of his allies went out of bounds. But it is telling that he let them go that far to begin with. But if you're an insecure autocrat, right, even the mere existence of a legislature is a threat. So if you're forced to have it, you go out of your way to deny it means independence. And this kind of explains this spiral that we see, or, you know, two equilibria that we see, whereby some autocrats have some semblance of stability in autocratic institutions. And then you have some autocrats who actively destroy all kinds of institutions. You know, countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo under Mobutu Sese Seko when it was called Zaire, which was a fairly deinstitutionalized country because the autocrat was had this paradoxical situation of being both strong but also very weak and insecure. And so such autocrats survived by destroying all potential centers of power, including, you know, parties and legislatures. So it's a distinction that I think the literature needs to acknowledge that not all autocrats are the same, and that there's quite a bit of variation in this institutional strength of legislatures and parties and other institutions under autocracy. And now on the eve of the return to multi-party politics in the 90s, what you have is, you know, what multi-party electoral politics does is it frees up legislators. And a single-party rule, in both Kenya and Zambia, you could only be a member of parliament if you are a member of the ruling party. Under multi-party rule, you could be a member of opposition parties. Now, that emboldens opposition legislators for sure, but it also emboldens members of parliament within the ruling party because they could defect and join the opposition. And that then forces presidents to give more concessions after countries become democracies. Now, when comparing Kenya and Zambia, the claim I make is that because the Kenyan legislature was stronger on the eve of its freedom in the early 90s, it was quicker in appropriating that freedom and using it to further strengthen its own institutions and power vis-a-vis the executive. So you see, you know, a rapid plummeting of the share of president's bills getting passed in Kenya. While in Zambia, you know, if you look at the trends between 91 and 2001, they're fairly indistinguishable from the trends from, say, 81 to 91. While in Kenya, there's a clear break after 91 because the president rapidly starts losing bills. And notably, this happens despite the fact that the president had a majority in parliament, both from 92 to 97 and 97 through 2002.
No, very good. That was nicely argued. And so in your conclusions, you nicely recapitulate some of these other conclusions, and both the historiographical ones, which I think are quite valuable in terms of developing new ways of studying post-colonial states and the development of institutions in post-colonial states. But you also have a set of more pragmatic recommendations, and you already spoke us to some of them in terms of what is it that we need to be looking at? How is it that these conclusions reveal new areas of investment, if we were to put it that way, in order to strengthen institutions of post-colonial states? Can you tell us a little bit of some of the insights that people interested more in the policy side of this debate could learn from your book?
Yeah, so from the policy side, I think one of the important lessons is that, there's no better time to start investing in the long-term development of institutions like today, right? Time here is a very, very important variable. We see that, think of the most autocratic, exclusionary form of institution, the whites-only colonial legislature. And the fact that even that institution in its age actually has a positive impact on post-colonial outcomes, right? Institutions take time regularizing and routinizing their processes helps make them stronger because institutions are a muscle. The more they're used, the stronger they become. In both autocracies and democracies, I think, if you can't invest in the political aspects of legislative strength, at a minimum, one can invest in the internal operational aspects of legislative strength. And perhaps, persuading autocrats, at least the more secure ones, to allow for means independence. Because that's possible under autocracy to have legislatures that have a routinized process of getting stuff done within an institutional context. The other thing that we should be mindful of is that legislative strengthening cannot be an apolitical process, right? Because a strong legislature necessarily means a balanced executive, right? So presidents will not willingly give up their power by allowing the legislature to be strengthened. And so part of the reason why some of the legislative strengthening programs fail is that, they typically have this naive assumption that this can be an apolitical process. It cannot be an apolitical process because we need to be aware of the ways in which, if you strengthen the legislature, they'll pass fewer executive bills. Smart presidents know that. They'll try to make sure that doesn't happen. So we should be alive to those concerns and address them head on as opposed to trying to hide away from them. Third, I should add that we should strengthen individual legislators' capability to fully serve their constituents. And this is, this is an issue that has emerged since many countries in Africa and South Asia and elsewhere have passed these constituency development funds. That those who see them as an infringement on executive action see them as fueling corruption and all. But I would say that if legislators are going to win elections, they need to effectively be able to serve their members. And I think, we should think seriously about how we strengthen that bond between individual members and their constituents, because that's a vital source of legislative strength. Members who have a personal vote and an independent basis of support among constituents is a member that can then be bold while in the legislature to champion their constituents' interests and to stand up to the executive when they step out of line. And so, without, say, you know, campaigning for any individual members, I think it's possible to think through systems of constituency service that would allow or trainings in some in some places that would make members better able to serve their constituents while in office. And I think that would go a long way in strengthening the bond between the vertical bond between elected members and their constituents, and in an indirect way, strengthen the legislature.
Oh, and related to those two last two points, in terms of strengthening members of the legislature, I think you make a very, very interesting point towards the end of the book about, for instance, how it makes a difference, or it would make a difference, the means by which, for instance, gender quotas are met, which I thought was something that I wouldn't have thought about. You know, it's like you said, generally it's a good idea maybe to have a legislature that has is gender balanced, if you want to put it that way, but that the means by which that is accomplished can either weaken or strengthen the legislature. So can you tell us a little bit more about that last point? Because I think it's a really insightful one.
Yes, because, you know, it's a good example of the point you raise is Rwanda, right? So Rwanda has one of the highest representations of women in legislatures, but the means through which it was achieved was through a party process, which leaves the women legislators actually accountable to the current president, as opposed to, you know, constituents in real ways. And so, you know, I think that there's evidence from India, worked by Rikhil Bhavnani and others, showing that we can use quota systems that allow female politicians to run and win elections. And indeed, you know, once people get accustomed to seeing female leaders, they actually, you know, shift their bias, some of their biases, and are then able to elect more women after having seen the demonstration effect of having effective women leaders. And so, you know, I think instead of rushing to nominate, have like a nomination slot for a reserve nomination slot for women leaders or parliamentarians, what we should be doing is perhaps having systems that allow for quote-unquote regular election of these same leaders. Because, you know, when we create nomination slots, what we're doing is effectively empowering the same people we want to check to be the ones electing a significant proportion of the legislature. And that serves to weaken the legislature. Instead, you know, in order to keep that bond between parliamentarians and constituents, we need to have these members elected regularly. And because of that, you know, one of the conclusions I make, as you point out, is to insist on, you know, a first preference for this quota system that's based on elections, as opposed to a system that's based on nominations. Now, it should be said that in some contexts, you know, elections may not be possible for a variety of social political reasons. In those contexts, having women nominated might be the way to go. Because indeed, the evidence shows, and you know, some of the work that I'm looking at now, the evidence shows that even nominated women legislators actually move the needle as far as spending on social issues goes relative to predominantly male legislatures. So, you know, nomination is a second best, but a first best would be a push for a quota-based electoral process.
Thank you. Thank you for that explanation. Well, it seems like we might have been taking a little bit too much of your time. Before we say goodbye, could you just tell us a little bit of what you're working on right now?
Yes. So, I have two main projects right now that I hope will inform future book projects. The first is on the politics of education reform in Tanzania. I'm part of a big team of PIs looking at education reforms in Tanzania since 2012. And I'm also interested in just thinking more broadly about the history of education policy in East Africa and the politics around it. That's ongoing work. We have a couple of papers that should be coming out soon, our working papers that should be coming out soon, and I hope to develop that further over the next couple of years. The other new project I'm working on is on the politics of devolution in Kenya. And here I'm interested in the question of subnational service provision and its impacts on political knowledge. So do citizens know their politicians, and do citizens know which tier of government is responsible for what function, and how does that affect how they respond to public provision of the provision of public goods and services? Here too, you know, my historical biases will show. The project is designed to look at how the historical experiences of national administration and local authorities in Kenya continues to influence the implementation of Kenya's contemporary devolved system, which was established in 2013. So those are the two main projects that I'm working on, and I have some other ancillary projects on the politics of electoral management and questions about use of technology in elections that are also informing some of the papers that I'm working on.
Well, we definitely look forward to hearing all about both, if not all, of those projects. But for now, I want to thank you for being in our podcast today. I'm sure our listeners enjoyed it just as much as I did. So thank you very much and take care.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure being here and sharing my work.